Hello and welcome to Think Ahead, a London Business School podcast, which offers evidence-based discussions and insights to help you navigate big business issues. I'm Julian Birkinshaw, Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship and Vice Dean at London Business School, as well as the host of our Think Ahead podcast series. As we approach COP28, the current and future ways of thinking around environmental, social and governance issues are again in sharp focus. This is a major topic for London Business School. As part of this, we've hosted a very special Think Ahead event at London Business School, which explored themes and expectations for businesses relating to this year's COP. We are also hosting an online exclusive edition of Think magazine at london.edu/think, entitled Better Business to Save Our Planet, which looks at ideas, challenges and sustainability solutions from across the London Business School community. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Yanis Ioannou, Associate Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship at London Business School. Welcome, Yanis.
Thank you very much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks. We're going to explore a bunch of issues related to ESG and sustainability. And indeed, we're going to talk a bit about the COP28 conference and the pressing issues that need to be addressed. And we're going to start with ESG, environmental, social and governance. That term's often used specifically around investing, and we're going to start with investing, if that's okay. And let me just start in a slightly provocative way. There was a recent op-ed in the Financial Times by a professor, Damodaran, at NYU, New York University. He said that ESG was born in sanctimony, nurtured with hypocrisy, sold with sophistry. And he said basically that ESG is beyond redemption. What's your thoughts on that?
Yes, Julian, I did read that op-ed and actually wrote a response to it. I think to a certain degree, it is understandable for the following reason. There is a gap between what we mean by ESG as a concept and ESG as an application. Let me just elaborate on those two aspects very quickly. So the first one is there's no question, and I don't think anyone would doubt this, that we need to understand the impact that businesses have on the world, but also the impact that all of these environmental and social challenges have on businesses. In other words, the types of risks that they create for businesses, right? That's the concept. That's the idea. And a lot of these ESG rating agencies only focus on the second part. In other words, the ESG ratings and rankings try to understand for the time being the risks that things like climate change and so on create for businesses. So it's very hard for me to understand how as a, as an investor, you would know there's potentially risks that you're not accounting for, right? And you choose to ignore them. Right. So in that respect, ESG as a concept that measures risks of businesses has to be integrated in investment decisions. However, clearly, this is an industry that has developed with several information intermediaries. Mm-hmm. Lest we forget that we're trying to measure very complex underlying issues and typically issues that have been ignored in this past. That's why we have a climate change problem. That's why we have a diversity problem. That's why we have an inequality problem. Right. So clearly, in the process of getting to better measurements, you're always going to have some pushback, some well-intentioned criticism, right. But that's only going to help to improve these ratings.
So if I am a private investor, I'm wanting to, invest my pension fund, or if I've got an asset manager that's investing on my behalf, should I be encouraging that asset manager to put my money into an ESG fund? And by ESG fund, I mean one that has been screened in a way that filters out, essentially makes it impossible to invest in a whole bunch of companies, for example, fossil fuel-based companies. Should I actually be doing that? I mean, let's be as practical as we can.
Well, it depends on you. In other words, what's your motivation, right? And in the investment industry, we have a whole range of motivations, right. And that's precisely why we have a whole range of funds. There might be investors who are, with their personal preferences, is about prioritizing impact. So right. If you're one of those investors, you might say to your asset manager, I am willing to compromise on returns, right. And I want you to maximize on impact. Right. If you are one of those that, you know, want to achieve market returns, then you can say, you know, I want you to optimize both risk-adjusted return with impact, right? Okay. And others might just say, you know, ignore all this ESG, which essentially you're saying ignore some risks and go all out into sin industries, for instance, right? So it is not, we need to have a more sophisticated argument because we need to combine the motives of individual investors. And at the end of the day, you also want to know how much is the asset manager going to ask, charge you? What is the fee, right? Because if you're saying, well, you know, you can say ESG, but do you want active ESG or do you want passive ESG? Right. Active is going to be more expensive. So there's a whole host of factors. It's not as easy as a binary decision, do it or don't do it.
So, I mean, we're a business school. We do proper, shall we say, you know, rigorous research. You know this field better than I do. What does the academic research say about the returns that we get from ESG funds compared to general funds?
Yeah, that is a very problematic area, right? Because we, as I mentioned before, we have this challenge of actually measuring ESG. We also have this very even bigger challenge of understanding the motives of individual investors and the actual investing strategies of the funds. Because I'll give you an example. Some funds might go with negative screening, for instance. In other words, I choose particular industries or particular thresholds and I exclude companies. Others go with positive screening. In other words, I invest in clean tech. Others go with best in class. So if you don't have an understanding of the clear motivations of the investors whose money you're managing and the actual investment strategy, and you put all of them into what we call a pooled regression, of course you're not going to find either way.
So if you take the aggregate data, it says the returns on ESG funds are not significantly different one way or the other from general funds. And I guess we wouldn't be surprised that that is what the data says.
Correct, for the time being. But there is some, there is, you know, you can find all sorts of results. There are some that would say, you know, they do at least as well. And in times of crisis, they, in times of bear markets, they might be more resilient, for instance, right? And that's what we could say up to now.
So even if there's no significant difference in aggregate returns, there is a general kind of positive correlation between companies doing sustainability-related activities and their financial performance, I believe.
Yes.
And so do you want to help us just quickly understand the slight inconsistency? Is there an inconsistency there?
Well, I don't think there is because we need to, this is a very important distinction in terms of what happens at the level of the markets versus at the level of organizations, right? Because lest we forget that if you are a traditional finance guy, you would say, well, there is no market, there is no strategy that outperforms the market, right? The market is efficient. So if you say, oh, I want to invest in innovative companies, right? Well, the market is going to price it in. The market knows what are the innovative companies. But that doesn't mean that companies that are innovative do not do well financially, or that the companies themselves should not invest in innovation, right? It's the same idea here. So companies that invest in integrating these environmental and social challenges at the level of corporate, of course they can do better, even if the market prices that in, right? So those are two different levels. So I am more comfortable that we have gone beyond correlation at the level of corporates, and we're talking about a mosaic of studies. A lot of ink has been spilled on this, but it is very important to understand that it's not the generic ESG strategies that work. It's a strategy, right? You have to detect it. In other words, you have to be more sophisticated in terms of which ones of all the possible ESG issues you choose to address, you choose to bring your corporate capabilities to address, and how you do it, right? So,
and we'll get to the kind of the corporate view in a second. But one last question on ESG's investing. One thing I read said, look, there's three different reasons that historically have been kind of offered for ESG investing. One is to get a risk-adjusted return. One is to sort of to do good in the world, as it were, just sort of feel good about I'm investing in the right stuff. The third is impact, and I think what they're saying is you have the capacity as an investor to influence the way that companies act themselves. Is that correct? So just say a bit more about the ways in which, particularly a large asset manager, is able to actually enact change in companies.
Absolutely.
How does that work?
So we need to be careful there in the sense that, especially for asset managers, they still have their fiduciary duty, right?
Indeed.
So their, you know, their goal, their objective is to deliver the risk-adjusted returns. But increasingly, we have seen this type of what we call shareholder activism. In mm-hmm. other words, whether it's about voting, whether it's about shareholder proposals, or whether it's about engagement practices with companies. Mm. And typically, the investment industry is approaching this from a risk perspective. Mm. For instance, you know, as a business, do you understand the physical climate impacts that your supply chains are going to face? Do you understand the disruptions that you might face because of the transition? Are you ready for a world in which there is a carbon tax and so on and so forth? So as an investor, especially if I'm an asset manager that is investing on behalf of a pension fund with a 20-30 year horizon, of course I want to know if you have any understanding of this. So I think a lot of this investors are targeting those kinds of companies from a risk perspective.
And presumably then an awful lot of that is then about disclosure and getting the right sorts of measures so that we can, as an investor, see what companies are doing without worries that it's just pure greenwashing. Is that right?
Yes, transparency and accountability and how you measure all these dimensions is important. But I do want to add a wrinkle there, because I think in some respects we've gone a bit too far on the disclosure, because there's an aspect of the disclosure questions that discussion that assumes that companies already know how to do this, and then the only thing that's left is for us to go in and measure it.
Right,
and that's profoundly wrong, because we go through a period of profound experimentations.
Right.
I mean, you know, think about insurance companies that want to price in climate risk. Mm. Well, do the world's climate scientists send in their CVs to work for insurance companies? Well, you know, some of them are, and some insurance companies have already started, hiring climate scientists. But if you go on things like biodiversity, for instance, and but you still want to price this in any kind of industry, you need, they say, that you need the expertise. So there's a skills gap at the level of individuals, and there's a capabilities gap at the level of companies that still needs to be filled.
And my hunch, not knowing it as well as you, is that the ways that we actually measure these things are still evolving, right? I mean, because, you know, unlike audited financial statements, where we've got very, very clear standards, the standards around auditing of some of these other things, these intangible things, is much flakier, shall we say. Is that right?
Absolutely. But the optimistic aspect is that I think we are on a fast lane to mandatory standards, right? Especially if you think about the European regulation that comes into force. Well, it was supposed to be, I think they voted for 2-year delay now. Mm. But what is, again, what is important, I think, there for us to mention is that the European approach is a double materiality. When we were talking about earlier, in terms of ESG, not only as the risks that the business is facing, but the impact materiality as well. In other words, the impact that the business has on the world. And according to these new regulations, companies will have to report on both of those aspects. And especially the second one, you know, companies know how to measure risk, but how to measure their impact on all of these issues is very challenging.
Got it. Thank you. Let's actually now move to the corporate view. So that's a nice segue. I mean, the classic debate here that everybody understands is, you know, the business of business is business. Our job is to make money, versus business should be accountable to a full set of stakeholders, people, planet, as well as profit. And that they should actually, you know, almost feel obliged to take that wider view. What's your advice to companies in terms of reconciling those? I mean, when you get asked by companies to think more clearly about their strategies for sustainability, how should they reconcile those two different that binary choice?
In some ways, I think the reconciliation of those two approaches is very simple. The starting point is as follows. The world is facing all of this, the plethora of environmental and social challenges, and those manifest in terms of fundamental changes in the competitive landscape.
Right.
For instance, your customers are demanding more environmentally and socially responsible products and services. There is demands for more accountability in your supply chains. Your investors are demanding more transparency on ESG. Right. You're facing more and more activism from civil society, from NGOs. Governments are regulating more. Your own employees, when they choose whether to work for you or not, or even those that are already working for you, you, they demand that you have this higher bar of conducting right. business. Right. So even if you were behind the veil of ignorance about these ESG issues, but you wanted to be a good executive, right. and suddenly you right. see that in your stakeholder ecosystem, your clients are changing their demands, your right. suppliers are changing their demands, your right. investor. I mean, what's your other option?
No, well, fair enough. But I think there is there's certainly in the short term, possibly in the medium long term, there's a trade-off between, shall we say, doing the right thing for all of your stakeholders and making profits. I think. I mean, do you accept that there's a trade-off there?
Well, strategy is all about trade-offs, right? Indeed. If there was any money tree out there that we could right. shake and have money for everything. But here's my other example. If you're a pharmaceutical company and you increase your R&D budget, do Indeed. You see that as a trade-off or as an investment? Right. If you're a company that decides to go digital or adopt AI technologies and right. you spend money on it, is that a trade-off or is that an investment? Right. So if you put the funds behind well-thought strategic actions to adapt right. to this right. Changing landscape, this is an investment in your adaptation. Otherwise, yeah. you're not going to be around as a business, Indeed. Right? And there, I think another wrinkle we can add is that, you know, the sustainability story has two aspects. Mm-hmm. I think one of them is that it's time to pay the bill. Because of the regulations right. and taxes, we're going right. to see an increase in cost of doing That's business. Right. Right. So the question for companies is, do you want to adjust? Do you want to invest right. in yeah. a world where you're ready on when those costs go up? Yep. And the more sophisticated of companies, having understood that there is a certain minimum that they have to do, yep. then they say, well, wait a second. It's also opening up opportunities. Yep. Think about electric vehicles, renewable yep. energy, healthier diets. Mm. All of those are big growth opportunities. Why yep. wouldn't you invest
well,
in them?
Well, indeed. But if I'm an oil company right now, or indeed a utility or whatever, you know, I will undoubtedly get a better payoff by falling back on old fossil fuel-based energy sources, and that's the state of the market right now. I mean, your point, I think, is that you can continue to do some of that as long as you've got a point of view on transitioning towards the cleaner energies. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Well, absolutely, but you know, it depends of what's our ultimate objectives here and what's our goal, right? Yeah. So, for example, if we start with a science based standard, that currently we're on an unsustainable path in terms right. of carbon emissions, yeah. Yeah. then working backwards from that, you can say, well, again, I'm not saying that companies are going to save the world. There's going to be changes in individual behavior, in corporate behavior, in regulatory behavior, even changes at the level of global institutions. So, right. so if I'm an oil company and I still make money today, and they do, right? Mm-hmm. And we've Absolutely. Seen this Lots. After the invasion of Russia into Ukraine and so on and Indeed. So forth, they do. The question, though, is what's policy going to do about it, right? And there are some estimates, yeah. by the way, by the IEA that, for instance, the war of the invasion of Russia in Ukraine has actually accelerated renewables because, yeah, I mean, there's long-term people, there's people that think long-term and say, well, what if this happens again? We're going to have much better energy security if we have renewables as opposed Understood. To depending on oil and gas.
Indeed. But, you know, if we just focus on wind, I was just checking yesterday. I mean, it sounds like Siemens wind business is now seeking loan guarantees from the German government.
Yes.
Ørsted, the Danish outfit, has just cancelled a couple of offshore wind things in New Jersey. Right. I mean, right now, there is a real problem that wind in the current financial market is not as competitive as it was even 5 years ago. At which point, if private sector cannot afford to do it, I mean, it then is incumbent on governments to essentially step in and help them. Is that how you look at it?
Well, help them is quite an interesting term because we should not forget that the fossil fuel industry is mm-hmm. on a regular basis, annual basis, even with regions like the EU that want to be considered at the forefront of the fight against climate change. Yeah. The fossil fuel industry is being subsidized by trillions of dollars every year. So I think the right comparison is, well, if the renewables industry had the equivalent subsidies, Indeed. Would they be competitive right now and for many decades, right?
Indeed.
So we need to be comparing same
no,
for
indeed.
Same.
And yeah. I'm going to agree with you that governments have to step up here and take that responsibility because it is very difficult for private sector companies to make choices which are consistently in the short term hurting their shareholders.
Of course.
And let me just ask you your view on Danone, this French company whose chief exec Emmanuel Faber was essentially kicked out because he pushed too quickly and too hard on what we would call a sort of sustainability agenda. I mean, how is that that's a bad example in some ways of what we want to achieve. Any thoughts on what he should have done differently to ensure that he maintained what everyone would agree was a good thing to do, but right. was painful for his shareholders.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I think, you know, always with the caveat of how much can you really extrapolate from one case in one Indeed. Particular individual and a company during a particular period, right? So I think we should avoid in the sustainability space saying, oh, sustainability strategy, you know, you do it once and you then sit back and enjoy the laurels of your success and therefore, you know, you'll always be a successful business. It's like innovation that you study, right? Companies go through periods of, you know, tremendous innovation, then you have a change of leadership, of governance, they fall back, and then they come back, and so on. So I think in the case of Danone, though, in my understanding of the situation, is that you have a case where, although the intention and the willingness to be a responsible business was there, the implementation and the ability was lacking. Because, you know, it's in some of the research I've done as well, is that, you know, if you want to address these issues, there's these two things that you need to put together, your willingness, but also your ability. What's the net cost and benefit of action? Do you have what it takes, the resources, the capabilities in order to implement? And it seems to me that in the Danone case, we had a, you know, lack of sufficient sort of synergy, right, between the creation of financial value and the creation of social and environmental value, perhaps at the detriment. Maybe it might well be the case that, for instance, what we talked about earlier as investments just went the wrong way.
It's possibly just pushed it too hard. And I'm also thinking about Unilever, which, of course, famously under Paul Polman became, you know, the kind of the champion, the standard bearer of sustainability. New chief executive Hein Schumacher is pulling back to some degree, not completely, but he's pulling back on some of their overly ambitious ways of kind of trying to create purpose around every one of their brands, right?
I would see it a bit differently. I did see the latest sort of strategy rethink that he announced, and I think that's an evolution. And it sort of makes sense because, Julia, let's not forget, this is very recent. Right. There is no textbook on sustainability strategy like we know about innovation and entrepreneurship and so on. So I think what's important, even for our listeners to understand, is that we're going through a period of profound experimentation at the corporate level. These are issues that they haven't dealt with before. They lack the skills, they lack the capabilities, and they, of course, they're going to run several experiments, and because they're experiments, some of them are going to fail until they find their way around. And on top of that, in this particular space, we're talking about issues that are continuously evolving. Right. Think about social issues. Social issues, a lot of the times, emerge because social preferences change. Think about diversity, LGBTQ rights, gender pay equality, and so on. So, you know, you try to manage them, understand them in a way that you haven't before, and then the issue itself changes, right? So I think it's natural to see a lot of experimentation and a lot of failure in the process of companies trying to integrate.
Let's now turn to COP28. And as I think the audience will know, I mean, these conferences come around every year. There was one in Glasgow 2 years ago. The one this year is in Dubai. And the president of the conference is Dr. Sultan Al Jaber, who's the president of, I believe, of ADNOC, which is the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company. I want to ask you about the prospects for this COP, but let me just note a couple of his objectives. He wants to fast-track the energy transition, slashing emissions. He wants to transform climate finance. He wants to put nature, people's lives and livelihoods at the heart of action and mobilise for the most inclusive COP ever. What do you think? Is this going to be a successful conference?
Well, time will tell. But I think that, you know, it's important to understand that we're going into COP28 with the idea that this is going to be what we call the implementation COP. Okay. In other words, we know the science, we made our commitments, now we need to get on with it, right? And actually reduce carbon emissions and phase out, as opposed to phase down, fossil fuels. I think that's going to be a very thorny issue in the
because in Glasgow they bottled out, as it were, of the phase out, and they chose phase down as
absolutely
the, as the Weasley sort of compromise, right?
Exactly, which was kind of interesting, by the way, a short story, you know, because India and the US at the time were the ones that last minute changed the language. And the irony of it all is that I think within a week after the COP announcement came out, the Indian government had to shut down coal plants in all the major cities because people were breathing in cancer, basically. The air quality deteriorated so much. So it's kind of this contradiction. On the one hand, you undermine global negotiations, and on the other hand, at home, you have to shut them down anyway because you're killing your own people, right? So, that's the climate.
So there is, I mean, as you say, they're positioning it as a first global stock take. There's a real risk that in taking stock, it'll be clear that actually countries have not delivered on their commitments, and that the prospect of only raising, you know, global temperatures by 1.5 degrees, we're going to overshoot that by a long margin. That seems to me quite a likely sort of situation. Is that your understanding?
The global stocktake is very important, in especially following the Paris Agreement, and I'll tell you why. Because don't forget that the whole idea of climate diplomacy and all these COPs, there is no global enforcement mechanism. Right. There is no global police. So what is this based on? Mm. Is it basically based on peer pressure and name and shame across countries? Right. That's what it is at its core. Right. So this global stocktake is going to systematically allow us to see, in my view, how much we have failed up to now to meet to those expectations. It's going to lay it out. I mean, I don't think it's going to come out as a surprise to anybody, right?
Right.
We had
indeed
so many IPCC reports this past year. We had the synthesis report in 2023. We had the new UN report that shows that if you only account the petrostates and the increases that they have in terms of the fossil fuel expansion, we are already expected to put in the atmosphere double the budget that we have available if we were to keep global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees, right? So that's why you see the Secretary General of the UN saying, you know, we are on the road to climate hell with our foot on the accelerator.
Indeed. It's easy to agree that we are in a tough place and it's not getting any easier. It's what our economics friends would call a collective action problem. In other words, everybody knows what collectively needs to be done, but there's no incentives for any individual country to do their bit, because if they do their bit and others renege, then we haven't solved the problem. So I'm not asking you to solve the world's climate crisis right now, but in this final part of the conversation here, let's just talk about what we London Business School, and perhaps even business schools in general, could or should be doing to at least do our own bit in helping us in the right direction.
So, as you mentioned, it's a very difficult problem to solve. But also, because it's such a large issue, in my opinion, nobody's an extra. In other words, in order to fix this problem, we need change in individual behavior, in corporate behavior, in laws and regulations, even in global institutions. Mm-hmm. By the way, that's why you have so much discussion about what is the world of the World Bank and other multilateral development banks and so on and so forth. I think as London Business School, where we can actually have an impact is, of course, on the level of individuals and corporates, right? Because we train the people, the managers that are going to either set up businesses, perhaps with groundbreaking solutions to some of these problems and new technologies and so on and so forth, or the people that are going to run these huge organizations that have huge impact, right? Some companies around the world may have billions of customers on a daily basis. Indeed. So if you can move a company of that size, then you can actually have an impact, right? So I think there's several roles from LBS. In other words, creating managers and executives that not only have a basic awareness, but have the tools and the skills required to run these businesses in a way that adapts to these new realities. As we mentioned earlier, companies alone are not going to solve this problem. But then again, you need the contribution of everybody, right? So I think we can specifically contribute. And the other one is similar to the COP28 event. We also have the convening power. In other words, we can bring together so many different communities, including policymakers, regulators, our alumni, our current students, our faculty, our staff, to actually have these conversations about, well, what can I do from the position that I am in to contribute to this problem, solving this problem?
Solving this problem, indeed. Yes, I think, and this is now me sort of adding to your answer. I mean, our students nowadays, they come through London Business School, they get exposed to all of these challenges in their core courses. And then if they want to, they can go on and take elective courses in sustainability. Mm-hmm. There's a whole suite of which I think you teach a couple of them. And increasingly, there are jobs available to them in this area. Is there one last word of advice you might offer to our students in terms of how they should be going, as they go out and get their next jobs post-LBS, how they should be thinking about this stuff?
I think that going forward for our students, if you want to be a successful manager, executive, or have a successful career in business, in the same way that you cannot ignore the emergence of AI technologies, you cannot ignore by any means the broader environmental and social challenges. This is the new normal in many ways, right? So I think they ought to be aware and they ought to be knowledgeable and they ought to be investing in the skills and the capabilities required if they want to run successful businesses in the next 10 to 20 years. But I think what I would also encourage them, and I think this is kind of more a more ethical or moral side, is that it's also for a good cause, right? As the whole idea of sustainability in terms of meeting our current needs and while not compromising the ability of future generations to do so, it's about the world we're going to leave behind. It's about the legacy of us as a generation, right? So as the book called The Good Ancestor kind of says, it's about what we choose as a generation, as individuals, to leave behind as our legacy. So I think the sustainability and ESG is a domain where the personal, the true north, the compass of what you, the impact that you want to have on the world as an individual, right, can actually merge with what you can do in your professional life and through business as an institution that can actually innovate solutions and scale them up efficiently, effectively, and profitably. Because that's what the world's problems need right now, right? Innovative solutions, think about carbon, for instance, think about diversity and so on. Innovative solutions that, given the narrowing of window of opportunity, that can be scaled up quickly, effectively, and efficiently. Nobody else is better positioned to do that than business.
Perfect. Thanks, Yanis, for a really thought-provoking discussion.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Think Ahead, brought to you by the editorial team at London Business School. For more faculty research insights and information about our Think Ahead event and podcast series, go to london.edu/think. You can also sign up there for our free regular email newsletter to get updates on our latest publications direct to your inbox.